I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Back in 2009, Condé Nast suddenly announced that it was shutting down the much-loved gourmet magazine after a 69-year run. Our guest, Ruth Reichel, was editor-in-chief of Gourmet at the time. In fact, she was on a book tour promoting a gourmet cookbook when she got the bad news. It was like a punch in the gut. She was unemployed for the first time in decades, and she felt terribly for her colleagues who had worked so hard and were without a job. She retreated to her kitchen to deal with her upset and her loss and began to cook for her family and friends. She kept a diary, and she discovered a community of food lovers on Twitter. She has a new book about that time, and it's called My Kitchen Year, 136 Recipes That Saved My Life. And Ruth Reichel joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's so great to see you again.
Nice to see you again as well. So why did Condé Nast close Gourmet Magazine?
I have no idea.
To this day?
To this day. I mean, it's a privately held company. They don't have to explain it to anyone, and they never did.
And was this book your way of sort of coping with that loss that you felt?
Well, not really. I mean, I backed into this book. I didn't, it wasn't like I said, okay, now I'm going to write a cookbook. I was well into the year. I actually thought, I'd always said if I didn't have a day job, I'd write a novel. So I tried to write a novel. Maybe not the smartest thing to do when you're depressed and feeling like, you're a complete failure. And what I would do, I would try and write, and then I would basically retreat into the kitchen. And, I mean, it's what I've always done right. when I'm scared. And it was well into the year. We were having a gourmet reunion. We have them. We still have them all the time.
That's good to know.
Yeah, we 6 years later, we still love and miss each other. And one of my colleagues, we always met in these, this very cheap and cheerful restaurant in Chinatown. And one of my colleagues kind of looked down at the greasy tablecloth and said, boy, it must be really hard for you after years of going to really high-end restaurants. And then he said, how long has it been since you haven't had an expense account? And I did the math. And I said 1978.
Wow. So what, 30 years?
More than 30 years. And he said, so for all that time, you were able to eat out on someone else's dime in the best restaurants in the world. And I said, yeah. And he said, you must really miss it. And it hit me for the first time that I didn't at all. And I said, I've just been so happy in the kitchen. I haven't even thought about the fact that I haven't been going to restaurants. And he said, as long as I've known you, you've said that your mission in life was to get people cooking again. Maybe you should write about it. And then it was like that aha moment. Oh, maybe I should write a cookbook.
You talked about feeling like a failure. Now, you didn't close Gourmet Magazine. That was a decision made by other people. But you felt like you had somehow failed, the magazine, the people that you were working with?
I felt I should have seen it coming, and I should have done something to stop it. I was the boss. I kept feeling if I had been smarter, if I had been more aware, maybe I could have done something. I don't know what I thought I could have done. But and I also felt, I was on book tour. I had to go back on book tour for their book after it closed. And, people would stand up and in these, auditoriums with tears running down their cheeks and want to testify to how much the magazine had meant to them. So I felt like I had failed the million readers of the magazine as well. I very quickly got to, I'm 62 years old, I'll never get another job, I'm a failure, to I'm homeless on the street.
Now, wait a minute. You're Ruth Reichel, and you're thinking after this long career, New York Times, LA Times, Gourmet Magazine, and you're imagining I could end up on the street.
Yes, you
have a very vivid imagination.
If you have defined yourself by your job, I've been working since I was 16, going from one job to another. And I'd always been Ruth Reichel, something. And suddenly I was Ruth Reichel, comma, nothing. And I really felt like nothing. And part of what I hope that this book will be for people is, like, you know, in my kitchen year, what I learned is that defining yourself by your job is a real mistake.
As you said, you have been working since you were 16 years old. You had, I guess it was the 1970s, you had a restaurant in Berkeley, one of those hippie cooperative restaurants. And that was a time when you could be sort of loosey-goosey about your career. I don't know if that was true for you, but, you know, things just happened.
Right. No, I was very loosey-goosey. I mean, I never had a real job with, you know, benefits and, you know, until I was 35.
Oh, wow.
Which in those days...
Late bloomer, right?
Which in those days you could do. And I kept saying, you know, I'm one day I'll grow up and my real life will start. But meanwhile, I just love writing about food. And then I suddenly was at the LA Times. Yeah. And it was, oh, maybe this is my real job. Maybe this is my life.
And then you were at the New York Times.
And then I was at the New York Times.
And you thought, well, maybe this is my life.
And then I thought, this is my life. This is my life, yes.
And during that long career of yours, I mean, were you one who on if you had a Saturday afternoon, would go into the kitchen and cook? Or did your life allow for that?
Well, it really, you know, I was a restaurant critic for more than 20 years. And you basically have to eat a lot of, I mean, at the New York Times, I was eating 12 or 14 meals out a week. So you don't do a lot of cooking. Then when I got to Gourmet, I was, you know, I mean, jobs today are, they're not 9-to-5 jobs. No. They're all the time jobs. And on top of that, I was writing books. So I didn't spend a lot of time in the kitchen.
At Gourmet, there were something like 8 test kitchens, 12 full-time cooks. I mean, extraordinary.
And that's one of the things I most missed. At any point, I could go down into the kitchen and be in the middle of a passionate argument about food. And, you know, maybe you should be using different spices or, you know, cooking this at a different temperature. I really missed it.
Let me quote something you write in your book, and this is about the book that you have written that includes lots and lots of recipes, basically a message to your readers, but you're not a chef in your own kitchen trying to please paying customers. You're a traveler following your own path, seeking adventure. I wanted to write about the fun of cooking, encourage people to take risks. Alone in the kitchen, you are simply a cook, free to do anything you want, and if it doesn't work out, well, there's always another meal. And some cookbooks, I have to say, you feel like you need a PhD or you need to have an entire day to go find all the ingredients.
Yeah, I really feel like it's important for us to change the way we cook. And I feel some guilt for this because, you know, in the food media, we've kind of persuaded people, one, that cooking is difficult, and two, that if you can't cook at a chef level, well, don't even bother. And to me, it's important for us to move from cooking as a performative act, cooking as a test, cooking as being about the result, and get back to the place where cooking is about the journey. And that if you don't make a perfect meal, big deal, you know? And that's what I really hope that this book will do for people, is give them permission, give us all permission, just to really relax in the kitchen and enjoy the sensory pleasures that there are to be found in there. You know, the smells and, you know, the sound of water boiling. I mean, to me, cooking is a meditation and really a pleasure.
Do you listen to music while you cook, or do you like the sounds and smells of the kitchen?
I often listen to, I love the blues when I'm cooking.
Cooking.
Yeah. But I also really like, I mean, I like to hear that sizzle and, you know, I like the feel of dough when it comes together. And I like to just be in that moment.
Do you have a well, there's some, lots of beautiful photographs in this book, I have to say. Is your kitchen well stocked? I mean, again, you can look at some of these magazines and it looks like, you know, kitchens that would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I designed my kitchen, and it's very small, actually. I mean, I think the notion that you need a big kitchen is ridiculous. I basically stretched out my arms to the architect and said, water here, heat there. And it's just, it's like a U that I can stand in, and everything's right in there. I mean, the truth is, I probably did my best cooking ever when I was very poor. We lived in a loft on the Lower East Side of New York, where we didn't even have a rolling pin. I used a wine bottle for a rolling pin, and I had one pan. You don't need. It's so great not to be a magazine editor anymore, you know. And I, you know, when I was at Gourmet, I could not offend our advertisers by saying, you don't need all those fancy pots, you don't need all that equipment. But really, you don't.
Is that one of the benefits of losing your job?
It is. You know, I can say, I mean, in fact, I have some very fancy, you'll see the pictures in the book of my sterling silver lined copper saute pan. It was a gift. Somebody wanted me to test it. The truth is, it's gorgeous. I almost never use it. You have to polish it twice. You have to polish both the silver and the copper every time you use it. And it's meant for people who have servants, not for the rest of us.
It's so, in about a minute before our first break here, but it's so interesting to talk to you about really decades when you've been so involved with food, and to think how adventurous people are now. I mean, the sort of very limited, and I know about your childhood as well, but a very sort of limited palate that people had back in the 60s and 70s.
I know, it's so fantastic now. I mean, this book, which is filled with comfort food, but it's comfort food from all over the world, you know. I mean, it's chili and hamburgers and potatoes and congee and Chinese dumplings and, you know, Japanese food. I mean, Mexican food. You know, our palate has just expanded and exploded in a fabulous way.
And that's Ruth Reichel, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And she has spent most of her life involved in food, if I can put it that way. She was editor-in-chief of Gourmet. She was also restaurant critic for the New York Times. She also worked at the Los Angeles Times. She's the recipient of six prestigious James Beard Awards, and she's got a new book. It's called My Kitchen Year, 136 Recipes That Saved My Life. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Also, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What's your definition of comfort food? Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Ruth Reichel. We are talking about food and cooking. Back in 2009, when Gourmet magazine folded, she found herself without a job. In just about 30 years, she worried about her future, wondered what she would do with her life, and she retreated to the kitchen. She also learned about Twitter. The result is My Kitchen Year, 136 Recipes That Changed My Life. You really became a country girl. You moved from the city, or spent much more time in the country.
Yeah, we have a country house, and we had never been up there in the winter. And my husband persuaded me that we should move up there. He loves living up there. And so we probably foolishly lent our apartment to some people. So we were really stuck up there. We have a small house on top of a mountain in rural New York, and it snowed that winter. It snowed and it snowed. And there were whole days, like 4 and 5 day stretches, when we couldn't get out, when we were just stuck up there, and then the electricity would go out. I felt very isolated, and then Twitter came to the rescue. When the electricity was out, my phone would still work, and I could tweet to the world. And I suddenly, I mean, it was so wonderful. I mean, one day I had some bananas. I mean, that was the other thing. We started running out of food up there. Mm-hmm. We now have a backup generator. We did not that year.
Things you learn in the country,
exactly.
Right?
And I tweeted, you know, does anybody have a banana bread recipe? I haven't made banana bread in years. And I got hundreds of responses from all over the world, literally from all over the world, and discovered that banana bread is kind of the kitchen sink of recipes. There is nothing, there's no ingredient that someone doesn't put into banana bread. But what I felt was, oh, I'm not alone.
Right.
This is like having my community of cooks at Gourmet. And I started having these long, passionate conversations with people and felt like I now had friends, a community of cooks all over. And it changed the nature of being, you know, alone in the country.
In fact, you have 400,000 friends, right?
Yes.
Does that surprise you?
Yes, it does. Not quite 400,000, almost.
Yeah.
And people who I communicate with every day, who I feel like I know now, who I've never met and probably never will meet.
You have a lovely section in this book. I've asked you to read it. It's just a couple of paragraphs, and it's you and your son, Nick, walking in that country area.
I'd never seen hoarfrost before, and I couldn't stop staring. It was as if some snow fairy had waved a wand, outlining every outdoor object in a sparkling coat. Up close, each blade of grass was flocked with tiny icicles. Nick and I went walking through the woods, following deer trails, looking around like wide-eyed children. The soft snow crunched beneath our feet, winter music, and we went farther and farther, thinking we might never see this again. We returned home breathless, red-cheeked, and happy. Built a fire, and began to cook. Few scents are as exuberant as that of a plump chicken roasting in its own juice. If you put some potatoes underneath to catch the dripping fat, add a couple of quartered onions, and throw in some whole cloves of garlic for good measure, the scent gets better still. Even if nobody wants to spread the melted garlic onto bread, it perfumes the air in the most wonderful way. All you need to make this dish a complete dinner is a small salad on the side.
That sounds like a perfect day.
It is a perfect day. I mean, hoarfrost is so beautiful. It is like walking in this magic landscape.
As you said, your husband loves the country. Do you now love the country?
I do love the country, although I have to say, winter in the country, I am dreading it. It's coming on. I'm not looking forward to it.
Let me read a couple of your tweets here, which you do include in your book. One is, wish I were in Venice, yearning for the sexy little ribs I ate there with my fingers, wine-drenched, garlic-crisped, slightly sticky, fine. I mean, in many ways, these sound like little haikus that you've written.
Well, you know, when I started doing Twitter, I loved the discipline of 140 characters. I mean, and I, every day I set myself to make one little word picture that, you know, how much can you evoke in that very limited number of characters?
Guest gone, completely satisfying Christmas, dishes still to do, but music's playing, and there are roast beef bones to gnaw. That's beautiful.
Yeah, I do love roast beef bones.
You do have a lot of interesting advice here, including what to do on Thanksgiving. And I thought that was some interesting advice in terms of all the – I've heard so many people say, oh, my gosh, this is like the most complicated meal I'm going to make in the year. You really disabuse them of that.
Well, you know, I was a food editor for 10 years at the LA Times and then for 10 years at Gourmet. And, you know, every year this – holiday looms before you. What clever thing are we going to do with the turkey this year? And after all of that, I have come to the conclusion that you should, and I've given the recipe for a high heat turkey. It's basically, you just put salt and pepper on the bird, you put a little water in the bottom of a pan, you crank your oven up to 450, you put the bird in, you take the bird out. And that leaves you time to spend on all the more important things like gravy, side dishes, pie. I mean, they're, you know, worrying about the bird is ridiculous. And there's no point. You know, turkey's going to be turkey no matter what you do to it.
It's going to take care of itself.
It's going to take care of itself.
Oven. You talk about Calvin Trillin coming and bringing a house present. What did he bring?
He comes every year, and he brings Chinese dumplings. He goes down to Chinatown, and I am so afraid that one year he will get a better offer for Thanksgiving that I decided I had to learn to make dumplings myself. And also, we gobble them up. So, I mean, we have a huge crowd that comes, and they sleep all over the floor. And we always gobble up these dumplings the minute he arrives. So one of the things about dumplings is if you have a lot of people, it's a really fun project.
Oh.
Everybody can, you know, sort of sit at the counter and pleat the dumplings together.
Kind of like kindergarten, right?
It is kind of like kindergarten, and they're actually really simple, and you put them in the freezer, and they're kind of insurance, you know?
Also, there was a recipe here that really made my mouth water, turkey hash with fried eggs. I mean, I guess that's what you do a couple of days after Thanksgiving?
Yeah, you know, you always have that leg left. It's sort of sitting there in the, or at least in our house, the leg is always left. And I thought, what do I do with this leg? And I thought, oh, we will make turkey hash out of it. Very simple. You just chop it up with some potatoes and onions and make a wonderful little crisp patty out of it.
Are you a good reader of recipes? I mean, I assume you probably are. You can look at a recipe and say, that will work or that might not work.
Yeah, I'm a pretty good reader of recipes. You know, years of looking at cookbooks in a professional fashion. You go, wait a minute, there's too much water in this. This isn't going to work.
Is it hard to write recipes?
Well, recipes are really interesting because recipe styles really reflect the culture that they come out of. And I really hate recipes that sound like marching orders. I don't like the ones that, you know, sort of like hold your hand and first you must do step 1, 2, 3, 4. And I've really tried to write these recipes in a way that's very different, that is a conversation. I mean, to me, we're in this together. And I want you to change the recipes, to make them your own. And if you don't have some ingredient, that's fine. It
really
doesn't mean that you can't make this recipe. And there are moments that I really want to hold your hand and say, you know what? If you're doing this particular crostata crust, it's probably going to fall apart. Don't worry about it. Just patch it all together. It'll be fine. So there's a lot of just me talking you through it.
Should people fret over, you know, a tablespoon of this or a teaspoon of that?
No, I mean, I have actually tried not to give very precise directions. I'd say, you know, a glug of olive oil, a handful of this, a bit of that. You know, I mean, you have to decide for yourself. I mean, we're doing this together. It's not, you don't have to make my recipe. You have to make your recipe.
Oh, interesting. I mean, that's an interesting, but I think important point about cooking and doing a recipe.
Well, that's what, you know, I mean, I figure that, you're intelligent. You know, you don't need me to, you know, tell you exactly, you know, I mean, there are people who love the Julia Child method of recipe writing. I always found it very restrictive.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, because it's really, it is a prescription, a lecture. And I want it to be a conversation.
I'd asked our listeners about comfort food. A tweet from Tola who says, we make the carbonara from garlic and sapphires often. Nobody has ever hated it. We love Ruth. Oh. I'm not sure what Garlic and Sapphires is.
But... Garlic and Sapphires is my book about
being
a restaurant critic.
Of course, of course.
And I have to admit that it's probably my most important go-to recipe is that carbonara, and I've put it in my kitchen here as well. It's a great recipe. I always have the ingredients on hand. You can make it in the time it takes to boil water, and it's true. Nobody doesn't like it.
And there is something about, and I apologize, of course, that's the name of your book. There is something about pasta and comfort food, having just spent 2 weeks in Italy. There is something about pasta and comfort food.
Well, I think there's something about carbohydrates.
Maybe that's what it is.
Bread, potatoes, pasta, rice, they're all very comforting. And I love them all.
Yeah, it's tricky. Ruth Reichel, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, and we're talking about her new book, My Kitchen Year, 136 Recipes That Saved My Life. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times with your definition of comfort food. There was a period where you broke your leg or broke some bones in your leg.
I did. I broke my foot. And I had to stay in bed with my foot over my heart for 2 months after the operation. You know, for many people, this would be a terrible trial. For me, it was like a great chance to, I mean, I'm not a sporting person, so I didn't mind that. It gave me a lot of opportunity to read, which was great, but I really missed cooking. And one of the great things that happened was my son came home from college one weekend. And it was so sweet. He came with a friend and he said, I know Dad will do his best, but we thought we would come home and cook a lot of great food for you. And so there's a whole little chapter about all the things that Nick and his friend cooked while they were there.
What did they cook for you?
Well, among other things, they made a quiche, which Nick had never made before. So I was sort of like shouting instructions from my bed. But, you know, there's really nothing quite as delicious as a quiche, and nothing as exciting to a young cook because it just looks so fantastic when you take it out of the oven. And his excitement with this, he took this like beautiful golden tart out of the oven was great. And then he made the most wonderful hummus. And this hummus is kind of a meditation because you begin with dried chickpeas. And then to make it really velvet smooth, after you cook the dried chickpeas, you take off every skin. And it's, you kind of do it under running waters, rubbing your hands together, which is, you know, either tedious, if you want to think of it that way, or really soothing. And he made this one. It was like a custard. It was just the most delicious hummus I've ever had. So the recipe's in there, too.
Yeah, no, I circled that one. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. So does your son have your passion for cooking and food?
He loves to cook. He does. You know, and you know, people who have grown up with him in my books know that there was one point in his life where he only ate five white foods, which everybody thought was hilarious that I had this kid who was so picky. Now he is a complete omnivore, eats everything, loves to cook. He and his girlfriend cook together. And I love the fact that he's 26, for that generation, cooking is definitely not women's work, which is a huge change from my generation.
Absolutely. One of the things that you made for yourself when you were pretty much recuperated from your broken foot was a peanut butter and jelly sandwich on white bread, right?
Yes, it is one of the few legitimate uses for
for white bread.
White bread. You know, I think peanut butter and jelly is one of the glories of American cooking and an underappreciated sandwich. But one of my tricks is, first of all, you use butter on the bread because the taste of butter and peanut butter together is really fantastic. But then, and you have to use red jam, but then you zap it in the microwave, which changes the texture completely and makes what you think of as a childhood sandwich into something that is just wonderfully sexy.
Never thought of a peanut butter and jelly sandwich as being sexy. So what, for 10, 15?
Eight to 10 seconds.
Oh, just to give it a little...
It just melts it a little bit, makes it a little bit warm, and changes the entire way that it tastes.
I remember as a kid eating peanut butter and bacon sandwiches.
Oh, yeah. Peanut butter and bananas.
And peanut butter bananas.
Or in my one of my closest friends' family, there is something called a Max Special, which is peanut butter with mayonnaise and sliced pimento stuffed olives.
Wow.
Don't knock it till you've tried it.
It's good?
It's really good.
I'll try one on you, which is peanut butter, lettuce, and mayonnaise. Can you imagine that?
No. No, you want the salt of the olives. That just sounds weird.
Do you miss those days of cooking in that restaurant in Berkeley?
You know, I loved it. I really loved it. I loved one of the things I loved was I was kind of the person who, and we all did everything, right? We owned it collectively. Everybody washed dishes. Everybody bussed tables. But I was the person when we ran out of food who was chosen to go into the back and make something out of nothing. And I loved the adrenaline rush of, you know, you've got like 100 people in the restaurant who are clamoring for food. And to just like throw something together, I loved that.
So what, there were grains or beans or veggies or
Yeah, I mean, I would like, you know, concoct, you know, a rice salad. You know, I mean, we would have leftover rice and I would throw in, chop up a bunch of vegetables and some cheese and, you know, make a vinaigrette and make a really colorful, delicious rice salad or do, you know, some kind of fried rice or, you know, you know, just whatever I could find, you know, make something with eggs. But, I love the adrenaline of, in the middle of the lunch rush. Was great.
So it's a puzzle, right?
What
are you going to do with all these things?
Yeah.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Ruth Reichel. She's got a new book, My Kitchen Year, 136 Recipes That Changed My Life. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and our guest Ruth Reichel has spent her career in food. She had a restaurant with some friends in Berkeley back in the 1970s. She was food editor at the LA Times. She was restaurant critic for the New York Times and editor at Gourmet Magazine until it suddenly closed. And that left Ruth Reichel without a job for the first time in decades. That was a number of years ago. Her new book is called My Kitchen Year, 136 Recipes That Saved My Life. And you can join the conversation 1-888-477-9499. I see some comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times as well. A question from Sylvia Louise on gluten. I have several family members who are sensitive to it. Is there a way to make your carbonara recipe for them?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of gluten-free pasta available in the supermarkets now. It's really fascinating. When I first got to Gourmet in 1999, we had no requests for gluten-free recipes. 10 years later, we were about to start a whole gluten-free section because whether it's true or not, and the science on this is, you know, pretty much says that most people who think that they're gluten intolerant aren't. But I mean, there certainly are people who have celiac disease, which is very serious. But there are enough people who think that they have problems with gluten that it's a really growing section of the supermarket. And now there's, you know, really good substitutes for flour if you can bake, you know, with all kinds of substitutes. And I don't think it's a big problem anymore, you know, getting gluten-free food.
Or almost anything these days. Sounds like you like the whole process of cooking. I mean, from the deciding what to make, the shopping for it, the cooking of it.
I do. I mean, and for me, a big part of cooking is the shopping. You know, I mean, I think that there's something wonderful about going out and, you know, talking to a cheesemonger, talking to a butcher, talking to a baker, talking to the farmer at the farmer's market. Those kinds of exchanges just make my life so much better. I've gotten all kinds of recipes really just standing in the supermarket and asking someone, what are you going to do with that kohlrabi? You know, you get great ideas. Food people tend to be very generous. And I also think that we lose a lot if we don't pay attention to the aroma of onions caramelizing in butter. And, you know, I mean, there's a, when you peel a peach, there's a color that's right beneath the skin that is like, it's like a sunrise. It's the most beautiful color. You only see it when you peel the peach. You don't see it when you bite into it. So I feel like there are all these little moments in the kitchen which remind you that you're happy to be alive if you open yourself to them.
And pay attention.
And
to
pay
them,
attention.
Right? And see them.
Yes. Yeah.
You have some lovely descriptions of going to the butcher, whether you're in upstate New York, and it sounds like New York City it's, as well. Just the kind of conversations that you have with, as you were describing, the people that essentially are making, growing our food.
I mean, I've really learned now from my butcher that I like one guy's pork better than another, you know. And so you say, you know, like, what does Sean do that makes his pork so delicious? And, you know, you start tasting the differences between grass-fed beef and conventional beef. And you mean, you learn things about lamb. For instance, I had this moment in our my nose-to-tail butcher where a woman came in and she said she wanted lamb chops. And the butcher said, you know, we sold out of lamb chops last week. And she said, you know, when are you going to have more? And he said, you know, not for about 6 months. And we're so used to having everything all the time that, you know, I mean, there's a reason why people used to talk about spring lamb, because the lambs were born in the spring. And now, if you're eating, you know, humanely raised animals, they have seasons and flavors.
You admit in this book that your knife skills are not as good as they could or
they're
should
terrible.
Be.
They're terrible.
And
you
know? That's just wielding a knife in the kitchen and being able to slice and
Yeah, but
dice.
You know, I'm surrounded by all these kids who have been to, you know, chef school, and they, you know, they have these gorgeous knife skills, and they look at me, and, you know, I've been cooking all my life, and I'm not that fast, and I don't hold the knife right, you know? you know, I don't swim right either.
But, oh, is that right?
But, you know, I taught myself to swim when I was young, and I didn't learn to breathe right, but I still swim. And, you know, I think it's, you know, I don't think it can be said often enough. Most chefs really don't like to cook.
Truly?
Restaurant cooking is assembly line cooking. It's very different than home cooking. And we are home cooks. That is very different than being a chef. And we should not hold ourselves to chef standards.
Including the knife skills.
Including the knife skills. You know, if you're a little slower and a little clumsier, it's fine.
We have a tweet from Lena who says, comfort food for me will always be a steaming bowl of Korean soft tofu stew.
Yeah? Yeah. I would agree with that. I mean, in fact, I have a recipe for mapo tofu. Not for Korean, but for Chinese, essentially Chinese tofu stew. It was one of the first things I made on the day when I woke up alone and terrified in my house. I thought, I'm going to go make mapo tofu and it will make me feel better. And it did.
You seem to have vivid dreams. I mean, you write about some of them in this book where, I mean, scary dreams, it sounds like.
Yeah. I'm
a
writer. I have an imagination, and it plays out very strongly in the middle of the night.
We have to get up and do something,
you have to
right?
get up and do something. So there are many, I think there's one dream in here where I'm being chased by angry vegetables.
That's right. When you worked at a restaurant, I mean, in the 70s, do you remember having dreams? I remember it from my restaurant days, having really vivid dreams.
Well, my most vivid dream is from when I was a waitress. And, you know, there was one table in the corner that kept going, miss, oh, miss. And I kept saying, I'll be right there. And I never got to them.
And as a restaurant critic, I mean, you got to live out some of that stuff,
Oh,
too.
As a restaurant critic. I mean, I would wake up. I mean, when I was at the New York Times, we printed in the early years on Wednesday in the culture section, and this is, you know, before the internet when you actually had to wait for the paper. And about 2 o'clock every Wednesday morning, at 2 o'clock in the middle of the night, I would wake up with absolutely convinced that I had made a terrible mistake.
Really?
And it was too late to fix it.
That you'd said, this is about a specific restaurant or something?
Yes, I mean, I would say, you know, right. that I had complained about some dish that wasn't even on the menu. Or, you know, you just get terrified.
Do you miss those days at all, your food critic days?
I really don't. I'm much happier cooking than being a restaurant critic.
And you were famous for these disguises that you had. I mean, I know some critics do that, including one here in Philadelphia.
I miss some of the people I turned into in my... I mean, I really loved being Chloe. I had a very sexy blonde named Chloe who was proof to me that blondes do have more fun.
Oh, truly. People could react.
I miss her, but I have a feeling I probably couldn't pull her off anymore.
But when you go to a restaurant as a diner, is that critic still...
You know,
alive?
I don't think so. I mean, as one of the most important people in my life once said to me about knowing a lot about restaurants, you know, he said, if knowing a lot just makes you not enjoy it as much, you're losing out completely. And I don't think I'm a natural critic. I mean, I just go in and enjoy the restaurant, and I'm not sitting there going, oh, well, this would taste better if, you know, it had a little more salt in it. I'm just there enjoying it.
But what's so interesting now, and I don't know how restaurant critics deal with this, but there's Yelp. I mean, there are all these sites that people can use with their own. You don't have to be professional at this.
Well,
you can just...
It's kind of great for the critics because what it means is that the critics don't have to be consumer reporters anymore. Yelp and all of those function very well, which means that critics can do what critics are supposed to do, which is give you, the reader, better tools for evaluating the experience when you go out. And, you know, you get to do real criticism now instead of saying, you know, spend your money here, don't spend your money there, which is really pretty boring, that kind of restaurant criticism.
Do you like to write?
No. No writer likes to write. I hate writing. I will do anything rather than write. But I love having written.
Well, it's funny because I was just thinking that we've had guests who have said some version of what you just said there, the joy of having written a book.
Or even, not even a book. I mean, on the days when you leave your studio and it has gone well, it's like a drug. You are so high from that experience that it's what keeps you writing. But it doesn't happen every day. And there's a lot of just sitting there going, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this.
That's the person on your shoulder, right?
Yeah.
The critic. Did you, though, was it hard after your 10 years at Gourmet just not to have that schedule, if you know what I mean, of like putting out the magazine, for instance?
Yeah, it's very hard. I mean, it's very hard to, you know, be totally responsible for your own time. It's a shock. You're so used. I mean, for your whole life, you've had to be somewhere at a certain time. There were things you had to do. And, you know, making yourself go... do, you know, meet a deadline just, you know, without it having it, the artificial deadline out there. But, you know, just doing the work because you're going to do it for yourself. It's very hard.
Yeah. I mean, something you have to learn to do.
You do have to learn to
do it. I mean, to do it for yourself, I guess.
Yeah, you do. You do.
It sounds like it's so interesting because I think from the outside people would think, well, Ruth Reichel, look at all that she's done. But what I hear you talking about are your anxieties about what you do.
You know, I mean, I think that unless you're a really unusual person, you know, from the outside, people seem, you know, confident and successful. In the inside, you're just you and you're looking out and... you know, filled with as much self-doubt as everybody else on earth. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons to write memoir for me was because I think it's important for people to know that, you know, when you scratch the surface, we're all the same. And we're all filled with the same, you know, worries about ourselves, doubts about ourselves. You know, there is no magic pill that makes, you know, someone, you know, super confident. I mean, I think, you know, I have known some people who are truly super confident. I haven't liked them very much.
Yes.
You know, I mean,
yes.
I think that's a strange person. And, you know, beneath the surface.
Maybe not so interesting.
Yeah. We're all filled with doubt, worry.
Indeed we are. And that's Ruth Reichel, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Her book is My Kitchen Year, 136 Recipes That Saved My Life. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. We were talking earlier about sandwiches, and one that you include in here, I scribbled down bacon and marmalade sandwich on pumpernickel.
So this is not my sandwich. This is one that I stole from Prune because in one of our many reunions for Gourmet, we met at Prune, the restaurant in New York, by the wonderful writer Gabriel Hamilton, who wrote Blood, Bones, and Butter.
Yeah.
And I ordered this bacon and marmalade sandwich because it sounded so weird to me. And it was delicious.
Really?
Delicious.
On pumpernickel.
On pumpernickel. And I went home and copied, made my version of it. And it's something I really like to serve, not as a whole sandwich, but cut up into little squares as a nibble with cocktails. I mean, it's savory and sweet at the same time. The flavors blend together really well. And it makes a really easy and really delicious little drink snack.
One of the recipes in here are fried oysters that you ate in Portland. You said it's like eating clouds.
Fried oysters. I mean, when I did this for the photographer, the way we did the photography in this book was when I called Mikkel and asked him to photograph it, the first thing he said was, I'm so done with cookbooks. I have no desire to do another cookbook. But send me your book and I'll read it. And I sent it to him, and he called me the next day and said, I stayed up all night reading your book. I love it. I want to shoot it. But here's the rules. I'm just coming with a camera, no lights, no assistant, and you're going to cook everything. No prop stylist, no food stylist. He said, the book is really honest, and the photographs are going to be that way too. So he said, you know, I'll come, you'll cook, we'll plop it on a plate, and then we'll eat it. So when I did these fried oysters, I had forgotten how great they were, and we just couldn't stop eating them. I mean, they were like clouds.
Well, that seems like the perfect place to end our conversation. Ruth Reichel, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
This has been so much fun.
Thank you very much. And her book is called My Kitchen Year, 136 Recipes That Saved My Life. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be right back.